Welcome to Breaking News to Trading Moves. Today, we are looking at a recent market event, one that really gives us a clear picture of how a regulatory decision, followed by an immediate legal counteraction, can trigger a tactical reallocation of capital within the energy sector.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be talking about a specific piece of infrastructure. It's a Sable Offshore Las Flores pipeline system in California.
And that's ticker SOC.
SOC, right.
And for you, the listener, this is a very useful case study. We're going to examine that immediate sell-off at Sable Offshore, and then we'll break down the strategic movement of capital.
So identifying exactly which groups of companies the market instantly saw as, let's call them winners and losers.
Exactly. All based on their perceived exposure to this kind of regulatory and litigation risk.
Okay, so let's establish the core catalyst that really started this whole cascade.
Yeah.
You already mentioned Sable Offshore, SOC.
Yep.
They saw their stock value drop by approximately 13%. And it was in very rapid trading right after the news broke.
It was a sharp reaction, and it was a negative reaction to a lawsuit filed by some powerful environmental groups.
The goal of that lawsuit was to block the restart of their Las Flores pipeline system.
Right. And the timing here is absolutely crucial. This was not some random filing that came out of the blue.
Okay.
Just days before all this market turbulence, a federal regulator, PHMSA, that's the pipeline, and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration,
which is under the Department of Transportation.
Correct. PHMSA had just approved the restart of certain specific sections of that very same Las Flores pipeline system.
And that approval was a big deal, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because PHMSA determined that those sections fell under federal, not state, oversight.
That's the pivotal point. For anyone who follows energy infrastructure, especially in a state like California, the difference between federal and state oversight is, well, it's night and day.
So why was PHMSA claiming federal jurisdiction viewed as such a positive step, at least initially?
Because that distinction is paramount. State oversight in California is, let's say, notoriously rigorous. It's highly fragmented. You have multiple agencies involved.
And it's known for leading to very long delays.
Extended delays, sometimes stretching into years. All because of these extensive public review processes. So a federal approval managed by PHMSA basically bypasses a lot of that friction.
So the initial approval signaled a clear, and maybe more importantly, a faster path to getting that asset back online.
It was a major de-risking event for Sable Offshore, for SOC. Yeah. It felt like they had cleared a huge bureaucratic hurdle.
But then that certainty just evaporated.
Almost
instantly. Okay. Yeah, the regulatory approval one day, which signaled the path was clear, and then the counteraction was filed, what, the very next trading day?
The very next. It turned the entire situation on its head.
And who was behind it?
The environmental organizations, with the Sierra Club being one of the named parties, they moved immediately. They filed a challenge in a federal court. And crucially, they also sought an emergency stay. And that emergency stay is what put the fear right back into the market.
Because if that's granted, it would halt the entire restart process completely.
It freezes everything. It freezes operations. It freezes revenue potential, all while this complex legal challenge plays out in the background.
So that sequence, you get certainty, and then it's followed by immediate, very organized legal action. That explains the rapid 13% drop in SOC.
It does. The market saw months, maybe even years, of potential cash flow just instantly put on hold.
So traders did what they do. They sold first, asked questions later.
They did. And this reaction really comes down to Sable Offshore being so highly exposed to this one single catalyst.
It's their core asset.
It's their core asset. So when that asset, which is the lifeline for their future cash flows, faces a sudden legal freeze, the company's valuation has to contract. And it has to contract sharply.
And that contraction is rooted in something you call the legal overhang.
Yes. That's the single biggest analytical factor here. This isn't just an administrative delay we're talking about. This is a sustained uncertainty that just permeates every calculation an investor makes about the company's future.
So the market isn't necessarily betting on who wins the court case 3 years from now.
Not at all. They are pricing in the cost of the process itself, the fight.
Okay, let's explore that idea of legal overhang in more detail. How does that looming threat of a pending legal action translate into a quantifiable risk for a physical thing, like a pipeline?
Well, you can think of it less like a black cloud and more like a heavy drag parachute that's just attached to the project's timeline.
Okay, I like that analogy.
The overhang refers to this cloud created by the pending or even threatened legal action, which is specifically targeting the validity of the operating permit itself.
Right.
So in this scenario, even if Sable Offshore SOC has a very strong legal case, and even if they ultimately win in court, which is entirely possible.
The damage is already done, yeah. In a way.
In a way, yes, because the sheer presence of these lawsuits guarantees delay, it guarantees complexity, and it guarantees expense. So the market reacts to the increased probability of process risk, no matter what the final legal outcome might be.
Let's break down the practical implications of that overhang then. The first and most immediate one has to be what you call the timeline drag. What does pursuing an emergency stay actually do to the physical operation of the pipeline, even if it's, you know, mechanically ready to go?
It creates a hard stop, a full stop. If a judge grants an emergency stay or even just agrees to hear detailed arguments about the case, the pipeline operation effectively ceases to move forward.
So the company can't proceed with its mandated pre-start steps.
Exactly. For example, they might be preventing from conducting final pressure testing. Or line packing, or introducing the actual product into the system.
So what does that mean in simple terms?
It means that Sable Offshore is spending capital. They're spending it on upkeep, they're spending it on legal defense, but it is generating zero revenue from that asset.
So the asset is ready, but it's legally immobilized. And every month that passes under legal scrutiny just pushes back that start date, which has to hit the project's valuation.
Precisely. For an energy infrastructure project, the valuations are built on discounted cash flows, right? Spread out over decades.
Mm-hmm.
But every quarter of lost operating revenue at the very beginning of that timeline is highly material to the project's net present value.
And this litigation, it rarely just ends cleanly, does it?
No. It often demands additional external studies, you know, new environmental impact assessments, maybe new geotechnical reports. And those studies themselves take months to schedule and complete.
So the timeline drag compounds on itself.
It really does. Legal action leads to mandatory administrative action, which then takes even more time. It's a chain reaction of delays.
The second implication you raised was compliance costs. Now, legal defense is obviously expensive, but how does the litigation itself force the company to spend more on the regulatory side of things?
The litigation acts as a powerful lever to increase regulatory scrutiny. It creates a kind of ratchet effect.
Okay.
So legal defense means hiring specialized external counsel, generating these highly technical expert reports. That's a direct increase in SG&A expenses, which hurts the bottom line immediately.
Right.
But beyond that, when environmental groups file a lawsuit and they're focusing on specific issues like structural integrity or flaws in the initial environmental assessment, the regulatory bodies themselves, like PHMSA, they become much more cautious.
Sure. They don't want to be seen as just rubber stamping a controversial project that later fails. That would be a black eye for them.
Exactly. So they might impose new, more stringent conditions on the operating permit even while the lawsuit is still pending.
Which means Sable Offshore has to spend even more money.
A lot more money. They have to dedicate substantial funds to continuous regulatory compliance. They might have to implement enhanced monitoring systems, conduct more frequent defensive reporting, maybe even redesign certain operational protocols.
And these are all expenses that were not in the original budget when the project got the green light.
Not at all. And these are not CapEx. These are high-cost operational expenses, and they are guaranteed revenue for the compliance and engineering firms. We'll get to them later.
And that leads directly to the third factor you brought up, investor caution. If the outlook is this cloudy, how does that affect the ability of a company like Sable Offshore to attract future capital for this project or even for others?
It severely complicates things all across their entire capital structure. Investors in this space, especially in midstream and infrastructure, they rely on predictable, almost utility-like cash flows.
Got stability.
They want stability. So when those cash flows are jeopardized by an unpredictable third party, in this case, litigation and activism investors pull back, and they pull back dramatically. That's why the stock price dropped 13%.
So if they needed to raise more capital later on, the market would charge them more for it. They'd pay a premium.
Absolutely. The perceived baseline regulatory risk for Sable Offshore has just gone up a lot. So if the company needs to raise new debt or new equity for an expansion or even just for refinancing, the market will price that capital at a much higher cost.
We're talking higher interest rates on debt or lower equity multiples.
Exactly. And that high cost of capital limits their flexibility, it throttles their growth potential, and it makes any future projects they might have on the drawing board less economically viable.
So that initial 13% drop is really the market just translating all of that sustained regulatory uncertainty directly into a higher cost of capital for SOC.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Okay, that detailed breakdown makes it really clear that the risk is priced in immediately based on that process risk, not the final judgment. But to understand the severity of this specific reaction, we have to zoom out and look at the context. Why is this particular pipeline, the Las Florida system, so prone to this kind of extreme scrutiny in the first place?
Context here is everything. Right. The Las Florida system has what we might call a decade-old reputation stain.
It has a history.
It carries very heavy historical baggage that makes this new permitting and restart process acutely reactive. It's not just any infrastructure project. It's one that is deeply linked in the public and legal memory to a massive environmental failure.
Let's talk about that history. That takes us back to the 2015 spill event.
Yes. The 2015 incident happened when the asset was owned by a different company, Plains All American Pipeline.
Ticker PA.
Correct, PAA. And it was a failure that drew national headlines because of the scale of the environmental damage. The incident involved the release of over 100,000 gallons of crude oil from the pipeline.
And a lot of that contamination reached critical coastal habitats, right?
It did. We know that over 20,000 gallons of that crude actually reached the Pacific Ocean. It caused extensive damage to very sensitive coastal areas, particularly around Refugio State Beach in Santa Barbara County.
That kind of disaster creates a permanent scar.
It does. And for environmental organizations, this specific piece of infrastructure is completely synonymous with a major ecological failure.
So how does that event, which happened nearly a decade ago, directly feed into this instantaneous lawsuit against Sable Offshore SOC, the new owner?
The link is direct and it's undeniable. That controversial past means that the safety narrative surrounding the Las Flores system, and really the entire region, is under extreme public and legal pressure.
So for activist groups, any attempt to restart the line, even under new management like Sable Offshore, is viewed through the prism of that prior failure.
They see it as a high probability risk scenario just waiting to repeat itself.
It almost sounds like Sable Offshore wasn't just buying a pipeline, they were buying a pre-baked litigation target.
That's a very good way of looking at it. When you invest in a company like Sable Offshore, SOC, you are investing in an asset that comes with an elevated litigation risk premium already embedded in its DNA.
So that inherent risk means investors know, going in, that every single operational step is going to be scrutinized and likely challenged.
That's what they're pricing in. The 13% drop wasn't just a reaction to the lawsuit filing itself. It was the abrupt realization that the historical risk premium the market had cautiously priced in was now being fully realized.
They're pricing in the high probability that every move SOC makes will be met with organized legal resistance, all because of that 2015 spill.
It truly illustrates how historical liability can haunt an asset long after the ownership has changed hands.
Okay, so we've tracked the shockwave that hit Sable Offshore, SOC. Now let's track the movement of capital. When money flees a high-risk scenario, it looks for safety. Where did that money rotate toward? This tells us what the market values when litigation like this flares up.
Well, the market didn't just panic sell, it executed a very strategic rotation. When a localized event like this suddenly raises the risk profile of one company and one specific geography, capital immediately moves to companies that are structurally insulated from that specific risk.
And it also flows to sectors that might actually benefit from the increased regulatory environment. So let's start with that first group of beneficiaries, what we're calling defensive midstream leaders. When a project like Las Flores gets tangled up in court, why is the knee-jerk reaction to rotate toward these giant, diversified operators?
Because diversification is the ultimate structural defense against this kind of headline risk. You look at the names that benefited: Kinder Morgan, that's ticker KMI, Williams Companies, ticker WMB, and Enterprise products partners, ticker EPD.
These are huge companies.
They're massive. They operate across vast geographies. They handle multiple product lines, natural gas, crude oil, NGLs, and they have immense balance sheets.
Let's focus on Kinder Morgan, KMI, for a second. You mentioned that a delay in California barely registers on their P&L. How does their broad asset footprint operationally hedge them against this specific California problem?
Well, Kinder Morgan's infrastructure is just enormous. They are heavily invested in natural gas transmission, which carries a fundamentally different and often lower legal risk profile than crude oil pipelines, especially in sensitive areas. Mm-hmm. So a small crude line delay on the West Coast, while it's a huge problem for that region, it has an almost non-existent proportional effect on KMI's overall earnings. Their revenue comes from long-term, fee-based contracts spread across pipelines, terminals, storage facilities from Texas to New York.
So investors just view their cash flows as exceptionally steady.
They do, because if one jurisdiction imposes a roadblock, KMI still has 50 other operational assets generating predictable fee revenue across the rest of the continent. They're simply too large and too diverse to be moved by this single localized friction point.
They're the entire highway system, while SOC is just a single off-ramp.
That's a perfect analogy.
I see the insulation. But wait, doesn't KMI have its own large politically sensitive projects? I mean, parts of the Mountain Valley Pipeline have faced serious litigation delays. Doesn't this kind of systemic risk affect them too, even if it's just a little bit?
That's a fair point, and it's why the rotation isn't absolute. It's proportional. KMI is subject to systemic regulatory risk on their large interstate projects, but the crucial difference here is the commodity and the geography.
Mm-hmm.
The lawsuit against Sable Offshore is specific to the highly contentious California crude oil environment. KMI's vast natural gas network acts as a stabilizing force. It often generates guaranteed revenue regardless of the current commodity price or a localized crude oil dispute. The market perceives KMI as having enough of an operational buffer to absorb that ongoing regulatory friction without a severe valuation hit.
Not like a specialized player like SOC.
Not at all.
What about Williams Companies, WMB, and Enterprise Products Partners, EPD? They also saw capital rotate toward them.
Williams Companies, WMB, is a major player, but they are primarily focused on natural gas gathering, processing, and transmission.
So, again, a different commodity focus.
A different focus. Their revenue stability is tightly linked to the long-term nationwide demand for dry natural gas, which typically sees less intense legal opposition than crude oil transport, especially in those sensitive coastal regions. This inherent commodity difference makes them a defensive safe haven in the context of this specific crude oil litigation headline.
Their cash flows are resilient because the underlying service-moving gas from the fields to the markets remains non-discretionary.
That's right.
And Enterprise Products Partners, EPD.
EPD is similar in its scale and diversification, but also in its business structure. They are a master limited partnership, and they are prized for stable fee-based cash flows.
Generated from immense infrastructure.
Immense infrastructure, largely centered around NGLs and crude oil export facilities in the Gulf Coast. Their strength is scale and their distance from the California regulatory quagmire. The market rotates toward EPD because investors are essentially betting that bureaucratic friction in California won't stop the broader national and international energy export market from operating.
So they're geographically and structurally protected.
They are.
Okay, that brings us to the second group of beneficiaries. These are the firms that actually thrive when this kind of friction increases. Environmental compliance and engineering services. It feels a little counterintuitive, but it's a necessary trade for investors.
Yeah.
Why does more litigation translate directly into guaranteed demand for these specialized services?
It goes back to that non-discretionary nature of legal costs we talked about earlier. When regulatory scrutiny increases, the volume of mandated administrative and project work just skyrockets.
Mm-hmm.
Every lawsuit, every mandated stay, every public hearing requires the pipeline operators to produce expensive documentation, detailed environmental studies, enhanced monitoring data, complex remediation planning.
These are tasks that the internal teams at a place like Sable Offshore just can't handle on their own.
No, they can't. So companies that specialize in providing those services see an immediate volume increase, regardless of who eventually wins the lawsuit. Their business model is insulated from the outcome because they are simply billing for the process.
Who are we talking about here?
Well, look at Tetra Tech. That's ticker T-E-T-E-K and AECOM, ticker A-C-M. These are massive global engineering, consulting, and project management firms.
Okay.
When a major pipeline owner faces litigation, the demands for defensive reporting, for federal court, and for PHSA compliance, they just simultaneously require contracting out specialized expertise.
So the court might demand, say, an independent third-party geotechnical survey to verify seismic risk.
Or an enhanced biological assessment of a wetland crossing, yes.
And Sable Offshore, SOC, has to pay TTEK or ACM to perform this analysis simply to defend itself in court.
That is the essence of the trade. These services transition from being discretionary spending to being mandatory, non-discretionary operating expenses. If the court or the regulator demands a new, detailed analysis of corrosion potential or a revised disaster contingency plan, the pipeline operator must contract TTEK or ACM to produce it.
Just to comply and continue fighting the case.
Right. So litigation risk, ironically, it guarantees revenue for the compliance industry. It boosts billable hours out of uncertainty. For these firms, increased friction equals guaranteed volume.
Okay, now let's consider the third category of winners: industrial safety, monitoring, and controls. This rotation seems rooted in that 2015 spill history and the subsequent heightened integrity focus. How does a lawsuit about an old pipeline boost demand for brand new technology?
It creates an immediate psychological change in capital expenditure priorities across the entire sector. The higher focus on pipeline integrity catalyzed by high-profile incidents and lawsuits forces capital expenditure away from new expansion and towards system fortification.
So the market understands that regulators, courts, and the public are all going to demand better preventative technology.
They have to.
So CapEx moves from building new lines to upgrading the existing ones. What specific technologies are we talking about here? The kind of things that companies like Emerson Electric and Fortive provide.
We're talking about advanced instrumentation, automation, and sensing technologies. The focus is on improving corrosion control, integrity programs, and real-time leak prevention.
For example,
operators are investing in sophisticated smart sensors and robotic inspection tools known as smart pigs that actually travel through the pipelines to detect microscopic flaws.
Okay.
They also need advanced flow meters and sophisticated control software that can instantly detect pressure drops that might signal a leak, automatically shutting down the system much faster than human operators can react.
And companies like Emerson Electric, ticker EMR, and Fortive, ticker FTV, they're the leaders in delivering that hardware and software.
Absolutely. Emerson Electric, EMR, provides these complex automation solutions that are crucial for monitoring fluid dynamics and process safety in pipelines and refineries. When risk perception rises, the priority changes from throughput efficiency to integrity insurance.
Which means sustained non-cyclical demand for EMR's product.
Correct.
And Fortive, FTV.
Fortive, FTV, specializes in professional instrumentation and sensing technologies. They often focus on high-precision monitoring. This includes things like advanced calibration equipment and integrity tools that are essential for running robust corrosion control programs.
The logic is compelling. Preventing a major spill is far cheaper than the multi-billion-dollar operational and legal nightmare of surviving a future one.
That's the math. And it guarantees sustained demand for integrity and safety upgrades across the entire pipeline sector, which makes EMR and FTV reliable beneficiaries of sector risk aversion.
That is a comprehensive picture of the flow of capital towards safety and stability. We've tracked the money that fled Sable Offshore, SOC, and landed in diversified names, compliance experts, and safety vendors. So now let's turn to the flip side. The companies penalized by the market, the losers. These are companies hit by either direct exposure or increased investor sensitivity industry-wide.
And this rotation is really driven by vulnerability. The Las Flores headline acted as a kind of measurement tool for regulatory risk, and it penalized anyone perceived to be operating in similar environments or those with similar structural weaknesses.
The market starts assuming the worst-case scenario might become a precedent.
Exactly.
So starting with the most obvious grouping. California exposed or single asset leverage upstream names. Sable Offshore, SOC, is the direct target. But why do others suffer the same fate?
Well, Sable Offshore, SOC, bore that massive 13% loss because it's the central subject. But the market uses this event to reevaluate regional risk for everyone else in that basin.
Okay.
If permitting risk is rising generally, meaning the timeline and the difficulty of securing regulatory approvals in California is increasing, then production ramps and expansion plans for any company operating there can slip.
So the market is pricing in the fear that today's successful legal challenge against Sable Offshore could be tomorrow's delay for a competitor, like, say, Amplify Energy.
Precisely. Amply Energy, that's ticker AMPY, has operations that are geographically and regulatory adjacent to this friction.
So if environmental groups successfully challenge PHMSA's determination that the Las Flores line falls under federal jurisdiction, that legal strategy sets a precedent.
It gives activist groups a powerful legal blueprint, and that makes securing any regulatory approval for any project in that same jurisdiction, the highly scrutinized California regulatory climate, a lot harder and slower for others in the industry.
So the market anticipates that increased friction and preemptively sells off shares of companies like AMPY, contracting their valuation multiples immediately.
That's the mechanism.
This perception of rising regional risk immediately spills over into the next category. Midstream operators with higher perceived legal or permitting exposure. These companies weren't involved in the current suit, but the headline acts as a generalized alarm for the sector.
It creates a sector-wide risk re-rating. Investors become immediately more sensitive to any company that already has a reputation for complex litigation or difficult permitting timelines.
And this is where that historical context we discussed earlier really hurts a company like Plains All American Pipeline, PAA.
It does. Plains All American Pipeline, PAA, was the prior owner of the Las Flores system during the 2015 spill. That historical context is essentially why the market still treats them as high risk, even though they sold the asset to SOC.
It's like they're carrying an unwritten historical liability on their balance sheet that the market never lets them forget.
That's a great way to put it. PAA carries the baggage of that 2015 incident. So when litigation surrounding that same pipeline system resurfaces, investors put PAA on a higher alert list for regulatory risk. It's perceived guilt by association, or at the very least, a heightened awareness that their past operations contributed directly to the current regulatory difficulty in that region.
So their perceived risk premium just remains elevated compared to a company like Kinder Morgan.
Oh.
And what about Energy Transfer, ticker ET? They are a massive pipeline operator, but their footprint is mostly centered around Texas, the Midwest, and the Gulf Coast. Why does a California crude pipeline lawsuit affect a company like ET?
For Energy Transfer, ET, which operates some of the largest, most complex pipeline networks in the country, the market reaction isn't specific to the Las Flores asset, it's systemic.
Yep.
The Las Flores headline acts as a case study. It says, look how effective environmental litigation can be in freezing a project, even one that had prior regulatory sign-off.
So the lawsuit validates a legal strategy for opposition groups nationwide.
Exactly. ET is often subject to intense regulatory scrutiny because of the sheer size and scope of their network and some of their past high-profile projects, like the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Right.
So when the market sees environmental groups successfully use litigation to freeze a project in California, the perceived probability of ET facing similar coordinated legal maneuvers on their projects elsewhere increases.
So it forces the market to re-rate the sector's legal friction quotient, and ET, because of its high profile, absorbs a portion of that increased risk.
That's what you see in the stock movement.
Okay, finally, let's examine the indirect losers. The oil field services companies. This seems like a step removed from the immediate legal fight, yet major service providers like Schlumberger, SLB, and Halliburton HAL, they took a measurable hit.
This is a textbook example of the supply chain reaction, or what we sometimes call the lag effect. Oilfield services companies rely entirely on the capital expenditure and the activity levels of the producers and operators.
Mm-hmm.
So when producers like Sable Offshore, SOC, and Amply Energy, AMPY, face uncertainty and project delays because they don't know when the product can flow, they tend to pause or retime non-essential CapEx.
Can you walk us through a concrete example of that lag effect? How does a delayed pipeline restart immediately hit the order book for a company like SLB or HAL?
Sure. When Sable Offshore's restart timeline freezes, they immediately halt or delay planned regional activity. For instance, they might have had a plan to drill two new production wells in the basin later this year, and that plan was contingent on the pipeline being active.
Okay.
That drilling program requires ordering specific materials, steel pipe, specialized drilling fluids, cementing services, all things provided by companies like Schlumberger, SLB, or Halliburton, HAL. When the pipeline gets an emergency stay, the producer calls their service provider and says, we're delaying that two-well drill program indefinitely.
And that immediately pulls the order for pipe and drilling fluids that SLB and HAL were expecting in the third or fourth quarter.
Immediately. Uncertainty translates directly into delayed purchasing decisions and cancellations of discretionary services. Producers just pull back on regional spending for drilling, for completion, and for major maintenance programs.
So even though SLB and HAL are global giants, the market is pricing in the anticipated slowdown in regional activity right away, knowing that capital uncertainty at the producer level travels rapidly up the supply chain.
Exactly. While they are massive companies, their regional market shares depend on active production. The market recognizes the mechanism of delay. Producer risk equals delayed CapEx, which equals softened regional revenue for the service providers.
So the hit to the service companies, while smaller proportionally than that 13% drop at SOC, reflects the widespread immediate slowdown in activity across that specific production basin.
That's the chain of events.
This analysis really provides a complete picture, starting with that initial shockwave at Sable Offshore, SOC, and then tracking the resulting tactical maneuvers all the way across the entire energy supply chain.
It does.
What we've tracked today is that these localized legal and regulatory events in the energy sector trigger predictable rotations. They favor those structurally diversified operators, the KMIs and the WMBs and the compliance vendors, over the single asset producers, and the high-exposure midstream names.
It confirms that in today's operating environment, legal risk, especially around environmental and jurisdictional challenges, is just as important to a stock valuation as commodity price risk is.
So the market is highly attuned to the ability of activists and regulators to slow or stop production.
And it structurally rewards those who are protected from that friction.
As we wrap up this analysis, we focused on the immediate stock movements and the tactical rotations of capital. But we want to leave you, the listener, with a more structural question to think about.
Yeah, we need to look beyond the immediate trading moves.
Mm-hmm.
This type of sustained regulatory and litigation friction, it dramatically increases the long-term cost and viability of major energy infrastructure projects, particularly in these high-scrutiny regions like the West Coast. So the question is, does this environment where a single asset can be tied up in court for years ultimately make it so expensive and so risky to build and maintain critical infrastructure that it effectively limits who can even participate?
Meaning, does this kind of sustained regulatory friction mean that, going forward, the only groups who can afford to maintain and upgrade critical infrastructure are the massive, hyper-diversified players who can absorb 10 years of litigation expense, thereby crowding out smaller entrants and potentially leading to greater market consolidation in the infrastructure space?
Yeah.
That is a strategic question every long-term infrastructure investor has to consider in the current climate.
A quick reminder that this content is for informational purposes only. This discussion is not financial advice, nor is it a recommendation to buy or sell any security. These are purely the opinions derived from the author's analysis of the source material.